From the Seacrest Studios and Children's Hospital of Orange County, California, welcome to Research 360. I'm Brent Detlefs, Executive Director of the Chalk Children's Research Institute and your host for today's podcast. My in-studio guest is Dr. Antonio Arrieta, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Chalk Children's and Clinical Professor of Pediatrics at the University of California, Irvine. We'll be talking today about Dr. Arrieta's research in disease surveillance and a topic increasingly in the public conversation, childhood vaccines, and whether or not there are causes for concern. Dr. Antonio Arrieta, welcome to Research 360. Let's start first with childhood vaccines and some of the concerns that are out there about their safety. Can you share with our listening audience what the current recommendations for vaccines for newborns are?
There are a pretty standard recommendations for immunization of newborns and infants, and nowadays all the way to adolescents, mm-hmm. as we try to prevent diseases, particularly infections that can be very severe, oftentimes fatal, debilitating. Some of them can result in cancer if we don't prevent them. So vaccines are of great importance. The survival of children have been dramatically improved with these vaccines. The overall outcome of children have been also improved. So they are of great importance. They're extremely safe. They are definitely safer than acquiring the disease that they're preventing. So I very strongly and emphatically recommend these immunizations, not only the immunizations themselves, but also to follow the immunization schedule that has been so carefully developed by people who are very dedicated to this.
You hear sometimes parents talk about a modified vaccine schedule, and what I'm hearing from you is it's very important that we adhere to the schedule, vaccine schedule that's recommended by the APA.
Yes, it's very important because they are designed to protect you at the time that you're most susceptible to the microbes for which you are receiving the immunization. Mm-hmm. So if I postpone a vaccine that was intended to be given for the first time at 2 months of age, I postpone it until 6 months of age, they are going to leave you vulnerable for 4 months at a time where you are at the highest risk of having poor outcomes from this infection. So it does not make any sense to immunize later and leave the children vulnerable to these infections during that time.
So you've talked about some of the risks of not getting vaccinations. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Maybe some of your clinical experience of children who have not received vaccinations.
Well, perhaps an example that is more or that is easier to grasp would be how in the 1980s there was a bacteria or called Haemophilus influenza, which was the most common bacteria to give meningitis to children. Meningitis had a substantial mortality rate of about perhaps 10%. And about 30% of children were left with long-term sequelae. This infection has pretty much disappeared. Subsequent to that, we now have a pneumococcal vaccine, which has decreased drastically the occurrence of invasive, severe, life-threatening pneumococcal infections, and children now don't get these serious infections. So these are the ones that are perhaps more visible because other vaccines have been around for a longer time, so people do not remember children with diphtheria or children with tetanus.
Polio.
Polio. I'm glad you bring that up because it's so current to see what happens as soon as you stop immunizing. I'm sure you are aware of what is happening in places like Syria, where they had very good immunization practice, and polio had been eradicated from Syria. And in the short time that this terrible conflict is happening in Syria, polio has, it has been difficult to immunize. So polio has, there has been a resurgence of polio seen in Syria. So it just takes a little bit of time to not immunize, to break the cycle, and then you see the disease come back. So now there is a lot of children in Syria who are going to be paralyzed for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think there's a sense of complacency that we sometimes adopt here in the United States because we have been, many of the diseases that we faced, you know, 20 years ago have been eradicated in large measure because of the vaccine. But to your point, we live in a global world. You can be anywhere in the world in 2 days. So I think it's not good for us to feel safe in our isolation because we're really not. Anytime we're on a plane or traveling to a big city, we have the opportunity to be exposed to these things.
I think what you're bringing up is of great importance because people tend to think, well, I'm not going to go to any of those countries where I'm going to catch measles. Well, most of the imported cases that we have had recently in California were imported from Western Europe, primarily from Switzerland, Italy, France, where similar concerns about the vaccine have been increasing, so immunization has decreased. So, for example, in data from 2012, I believe it was the correct year, showed that there were close to 30,000 cases of measles in France, and more than half of those happened in Paris. Mm-hmm. So people who were going to Paris didn't know, but they were being exposed to measles.
Yeah. I read somewhere in the recent literature that of the measles, of the kids that got measles, over 90% of them had not received the measles vaccine, and the other 10%, their vaccine status was uncertain. So quite effective when you get it, but real risk when kids are not immunized.
Yes, that's correct. A substantial number or proportion of the children who acquired measles during the most recent small outbreak in California were children who had intentionally not been immunized. It's very important to say intentionally because sometimes one could be unimmunized because of underlying diseases that prevent you from receiving live virus immunizations. But in this case, were children that could have been immunized but were not immunized. Fortunately, because of the low frequency of mortality associated with measles, which is in the order of 0.5 per 100 cases, we didn't see any fatalities. But if we were to see enough of those, some will die.
Yeah, that's often what I hear when I talk with new parents about their kids. You know, oh, we'll just let them get the disease. They'll develop immunity naturally. They're not seeing what you see on the front lines of medicine, many of these kids that don't have vaccines who suffer a really bad outcome. And I'm not here to scare our listening audience, but can you share, pertussis, we recently, in the past 2 years, have had an outbreak of that. This can be a fatal disease in children, right?
Yes, definitely. What has happened with pertussis is very interesting because the immunity to pertussis decreases over time, whether naturally acquired or due to immunization. So our youngest babies are those who are most vulnerable to adults and adolescents who have pertussis. Is not recognized because the symptoms are different, and then they transmit this to these babies who have a very high risk of mortality. Mm-hmm. We had an outbreak in California 2 years ago, and we had three fatalities due to pertussis. At least one of those was in our hospital, I believe two. Dr. Nieves, my associate, published our data trying to highlight these problems and energized immunization practices. So yes, it is. We keep giving, and that highlights the point that we should not postpone immunizations. The most vulnerable child is the youngest one, the highest risk of dying is in the youngest one. So if you postpone immunization, then you're going to have the unintended consequences that you're going to have your most vulnerable child acquiring the disease and experiencing death.
Yeah. So there's an individual risk to the child of not getting immunized. But talk, if you will, a little bit more, and certainly the case in Syria is a real example of what we're talking about here, the responsibility that we all have as individuals, as part of a community, to immunize kids.
Well, it is, I think perhaps the best way to answer is to explain what we call herd immunity, which is if we have enough members of a community that are immune to a particular disease, then that disease is going to be very difficult to spread in that community, because if one person develops that particular disease, nobody around that person is susceptible, so it can't transmit beyond that person. But if you find one more susceptible person, then that person will get it, and then another one and another one. So, for example, for measles, we need a 10% of immune people within our community to have herd immunity. There is a large portion of the population that cannot be immunized because they are too young. There is another portion of the population that cannot be immunized because they have immune deficiencies. So you have a constant baseline of 5-6% of people in the community that are not immunized, so are susceptible. So it's very easy to go above 10% if we were to stop immunizing our young children, and then measles will spread throughout the community very efficiently and would be very dangerous for our children.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about kids that may be too young for vaccination, or kids that are immune suppressed and should not. Are there any other groups of kids that parents should be aware of that should be cautious about getting vaccinations?
Each vaccination has its very specific limitations. They are extremely rare, but depending how the vaccine was prepared, there are certain vaccines that are contraindicated in people who have life-threatening reactions to egg protein, for example. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any other one right now, but there are very few well-known limitations or contraindications for immunizations, and they are immunization-specific. But some of the most common immunizations that we use, like pertussis, tetanus, Haemophilus influenza, pneumococcus, mm-hmm. They really don't have any significant contraindications.
It's good to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So most kids out there should be vaccinated, yeah. And obviously if there are concerns, to talk with your physician about them. So let's talk about some of the out there in the blogosphere, you and I would call them myths. Some of these parents out there are really believing, but is there an association, proven association in the peer-reviewed literature that as scientists we trust, that shows any association between vaccination and autism?
No.
Succinctly answered. Right?
Well, sometimes when one tries to explain too much, then people start finding ways to think that I was being weak or wishy-washy about it. It's important to know that many years ago, a doctor in the UK decided to show, it was a gastroenterologist who decided that he was going to show that measles vaccine was associated with autism. And it took one paper by him to question the efficacy and safety of the vaccine for the rest of the world. It took about 20 years to be able to refute with solid data his paper. The Lancet, which is one of the most prestigious journals in the world, had to apologize and recant that publication, and it was shown that this gentleman had actually even fabricated patients. So there are no data that suggest that children who receive measles immunization are going to be at higher risk for autism. There is a rise in autism. There is a rise in the diagnosis of autism. But the children who get diagnosed with autism have expanded. there are more ways to receive a diagnosis of autism. So we call it now autism spectrum disease because we're being more and more inclusive of children into that diagnosis of autism. Also, you have to keep in mind that the signs and symptoms consistent with autism are not readily noticeable until the child can efficiently communicate with his or her surroundings. So that happens at about the same age when one is getting those immunizations. So it's very easy to do a temporal association in between the immunizations and the onset of the signs and symptoms that were eventually thought to be autism.
But critically important, those associations have not been proven to be causally related in any of the peer-reviewed scientific literature.
The data that led to believe that that was the case has been discredited scientifically, and there are no data that suggest that immunizations are associated with autism. And I can say that categorically.
Thank you. How about cancer? There's some talk out there that some of these vaccines may be related over a longer period of time to the development of cancer. Some of the research I've seen actually show that some of these vaccines may be protective against certain kinds of cancer. But can you, anything out there in the literature that suggests any relationship between cancer and vaccines?
I'm not sure of the misinformation that you are talking about in regards to cancer due to vaccines. I'm a little bit saddened that that could even be out there. But no, actually, there are vaccines that are specifically designed to prevent cancer. That is hepatitis B. It's a vaccine to prevent hepatitis B, which is used to be the most common cause for liver cancer. And now we have a human papillomavirus vaccine, which is meant to prevent cervical cancer in women. A very severe type of cervical cancer, which is adenocarcinoma of the cervix. It is not meant to prevent all types of human papilloma virus infections. There is a multitude of these viruses. It's designed to prevent infection by those that will likely result in adenocarcinoma of the cervix in women.
Yes, some of the criticism of that vaccine is the vaccine is effective against, I think, two strains of HPV, and there are hundreds out there. So you often hear that it doesn't protect against all of the strains. So that's some of the criticism that's about the vaccine. But you recommend that vaccine for the young women that are out there?
My daughter has it.
Yeah, there you go.
My daughter has been immunized.
And what about, at what age do you recommend that?
At 12.
At 12, okay. And what about for boys?
Well, it is very interesting. For the longest time, this was a vaccine for girls. But there are some data that suggest that infection with HPV in genitalia of boys can result in genitalia cancer in boys. When boys acquire rectal human papillomavirus, then they can also develop cancer. And furthermore, after all, the most common vehicle for girls to acquire HPV or human papillomavirus are boys. Mm-hmm. So if you immunize the boys, you stop the vector.
Help to prevent, yes. So yes. Are you recommending this vaccine for
yes.
your young boys?
Okay. Yes.
And at what age again for them, 12 or 13?
12. And 12. The only reason for 12 is not a safety reason. It's just you just want to try to capture everybody before they become
sexually active.
Who is our audience?
Yeah. We have parents and young people, yeah. But we want to give good information
yes.
out there.
You so. Know, is the idea is to try to catch children before they become sexually active. And, it is common, although fortunately less common. There are data, very recent data in the MMWR that suggests or shows that pregnancy in girls under 18 years of age is decreasing significantly, but still it's a significant problem. So girls are deciding to engage in sexual activity at a very young age. What is very interesting is that in that data that I'm talking about 80% of the girls that had been pregnant before the age of 15, nobody had ever spoken to them about sex prior to them becoming pregnant.
Which is why it's good for us to talk about this and to have an expert
and
talking.
When you mentioned that parents were listening to this, I think it's important to understand that it's a topic of conversation that needs to be approached. I think we're all kind of a little bit uncomfortable approaching it with very young kids. We tend to believe that if we don't talk about it, it's not going to happen. But the data suggests that most of the girls who engage in early sexual activity had been girls who had never received any education by either the parents or at school.
Yeah, that's a very important message to get out there. Thank you for talking about that. Cultural perceptions of vaccines, is it different? Is there a different perception that you find with your Hispanic population than non-Hispanic? Or we see a lot of those kids here and parents?
I think we Hispanics have seen these diseases more recently, or our parents have seen them. I myself have had pretty much every disease for which we immunize today. I come from a terrible country. I have proof of having had tuberculosis. I have had chickenpox, measles. I didn't have pertussis that I know. I've had rubella, mumps. I didn't have meningitis, thank God. I have seen many children with diphtheria. I would rather not ever see one again. It is devastating to try to take care of one of these children. I have seen children with tetanus. I have seen children with neonatal tetanus. And it's extremely painful to them. And it's a very difficult disease for them with a very high fatality rate. So I am very familiar with these diseases. And people, whether Hispanic or otherwise, who come from countries where these diseases are unfortunately still common, are very aware of them and are very eager to immunize their children against these diseases.
Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. They're much closer, so their willingness to prevent some of the devastation they've seen firsthand is maybe much more than some of us who have been distant from that for a long period of time.
So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been so fortunate to know you for over 18 years, and I know you as a researcher, so talk a little bit about some of the research that you're doing on disease surveillance, I know, particularly looking at diseases in the hospital setting. Tell us a little bit about the research that you're doing.
Well, I'm mainly a clinician who loves research. My research is not as sophisticated as that of other members of our institution who really do find state-of-the-art, cutting-edge research like Dr. Nugent, Dr. Abdener, Dr. Cooper. I'm a clinician, and but
I can say for certain, Dr. Arrieta is being modest.
but even in the clinical realm, there are everyday opportunities to do research and to find answers that are going to help us deal better with some of the common diseases. And the beauty of clinical research is that it can help today. All the research is the promise of that perhaps things are going to be better in the near, mid, or long future. But when you do some of the clinical research that I do today, we are changing practice immediately, and our findings have helped save the lives of many, many children. So I'm very happy. I'm very proud of what we do here at CHOQ.
I'm very proud of what you do here.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us maybe one of the most exciting findings that you would like to share with our audience, or something that you're looking at now that you think will lead to something important?
Well, right now we are. As I was telling Dr. Lubinsky, my most exciting projects are unfunded, and I am still carrying them somehow. Right now, we're looking at E. coli, which is a bacteria that is the most common bacteria to give urine infections in all people, including children. In younger children, it could be more invasive. It can get into the bloodstream. And when E. coli gets into the bloodstream, it could also get into the brain, and then that infection becomes very severe and life-threatening. Our research has strongly suggested that children over 6 weeks of age, even when that E. coli gets into the bloodstream due to urinary infection, it is not as virulent. They do not get meningitis. They do not die from that E. coli in the bloodstream. While in children under 6 weeks of age, they do have a significant complications, a rate or frequency of complications such as meningitis or even fatality. So right now we're researching in this area because we believe that there is a switch on the E. coli, on the type of E. coli that invades us after 6 weeks of life. I'm trying to be safe and not saying 4 weeks because mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit safer to go to 6 weeks. So we're exploring to see if this E. coli that infect children after 6 weeks of life and almost only through urinary tract infection are less virulent, and then we can treat these children with less invasive modalities without doing invasive or uncomfortable procedures and limiting treatment in the hospital with IV antibiotics, etc. Yeah,
very interesting.
So that's an area where we're looking at right now, where, as you know, we are trying to better understand what causes severe pneumonia in children that come with a collection of pus in their chest. We have been collecting pus from these children's chest with their consent for the last year, and we're intending to do it over the next 4 years to see if the impact of a new vaccine that was introduced in 2013. Some of our data suggests that pneumococcus is going to be eradicated as responsible for these type of infections, which we leave Staph aureus as the cause most often of these. And it ought to change the way we manage and treat these infections. So we're trying to prove this hypothesis and then tell the world that we probably should be doing these differently. So those are some of the things that I'm doing right now.
Yes, yes.
And so, yeah.
Well, you'll have to come back and tell us how the results of those studies turn out. And again, it's really a pleasure to have you here. Yeah. We've been friends for a long time, I'm glad for our audience to hear about some of the work you do in your spare time in research to help advance the health of our kids, not just here, but around the world. I have a quick question for you. You grew up in Peru. Who was a hero of yours?
May I make a comment before we move in that direction, if we have time? I can't talk about research without saying thank you to some people. I need to thank you. And you as representing the organization, CHOC, to whom I am immensely grateful for its support in as much as possible of my research, Dr. Mignon, Dr. Lubinsky, Dr. Anas, and all the members of the PSF who have supported from their own finances several times the research that I do. The foundation, the CHOC Foundation, the young ladies from the CHOC Foundation that are constantly trying to find me funding for me to be able to do this research. So I can't do anything without all these individuals behind helping me fulfill my dreams of someday finding something really exciting.
Well, thank you, Antonio.
If I forgot anybody, I feel like I'm in the Oscars. but I felt it was imperative that I thank CHOC, you, Dr. Mignon, the PSF, because they have, and the CHOC Foundation as part of CHOC, they have been instrumental of anything that I have been able to accomplish.
Well, it's part of our mission, and we certainly appreciate the efforts that you and your physician colleagues have put into helping us.
It's important to say
that
because I think oftentimes people say that the CHOC doesn't support research, and I always tell them that they are wrong. I mean, I'm sure if they could do even more. They would, but within the limitations, they do support research. Yeah. So
we are very grateful for that as well. You and me both.
Yes,
Dr. Arrieta, thank you for being my guest today on Research 360.
Want me to ask you a question about?
It's a real well. I think we're running out of time here.
Yeah.
We will definitely come back and do this another time.
We talk
time.
Too much.
No, that's good.
You guys have to
helps me
you.
Out. All right. And if you, our audience, would like to find out more about the research underway at Chalk Children's, log on to our website at www.chalk.org. And as always, a big shout out to our patients and families. We at Chalk never forget that you are the reason that we're here. In ways big and small, I hope that we found a way to make your day a little brighter and that you'll be home with those you love very soon. From all of us here at Chalk Children's, thank you for joining us for another edition of Research 360. I'm your host, Brent Detlefs, reminding you that if you live in Orange County, California, Chalk Children's is your local children's hospital. And remember, research matters.
Thank you. Thank you very much.